From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Access to mental health resources is one of the six major unmet needs in the Cape Fear region. That's according to New Hanover Regional Medical Center's 2016 Community Needs Assessment Survey, which examines New Hanover, Brunswick, and Pender counties. Suicide is one of the 10 leading causes of death in southeastern North Carolina, despite the fact that it's not in the top 10 statewide. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, one American in five lives with a mental health condition. One in 25 has a serious mental illness. The scope of the issue in the Tri-County region, according to the NHRMC survey, is apparent. It wasn't uncommon less than 2 years ago for NHRMC to hold 20 to 40 patients, sometimes more, waiting for placement in a facility. But what does this mean? Are we crazier than we've ever been? Are more people being diagnosed? Or are our views of what it means to be mentally healthy evolving? We're going to look at those questions today during Mental Health Awareness Month, as well as whether the modern world exacerbates some mental health issues. We'll also explore the factors that influence mental health, some metacognitive tools, and whether people can actually get better. Our guides today are Susan Lewis. She is a licensed clinical social worker practicing as a staff psychotherapist at the Community Counseling Center in Wilmington. She specializes in counseling families experiencing grief, depression, anxiety, trauma, relationship issues, and issues of faith and spirituality. Susan Lewis, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Rebecca Ramp is both a clinical psychologist and the outreach coordinator for counseling services at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. We might refer to her as Becca throughout the program. Some of her areas of interest include self-esteem, relationships, family of origin concerns, identity development, and self-soothing behaviors and self-management. Welcome to the program, Rebecca Ramp.
Thank you so much, Rachel, and thank you to you all for making this a priority on the show today.
We're very glad to have this conversation. And we, of course, are inviting you to join the conversation. Have you found mental health strategies that work for you? What have you tried that hasn't worked? Do you think there's still a stigma surrounding mental health services? You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Rebecca Ramp, are we seeing an increase in the number of people who are mentally ill? Are we seeing an increase in diagnosis, meaning more people actually seeking help? Or are we seeing people seek treatment for issues that 20 years ago might not have been considered a mental health issue? And it can only be one of those answers.
I would say all of the above. It certainly, we'd like to think as a profession, I'm sure Susan would too, that we've done a better job of decreasing stigma. We've done a better job of making the services more accessible and making people feel more comfortable and safe coming in and talking to us and wanting to seek out those services and admitting that they need some support around mental health concerns, which is a huge accomplishment if we think about it that way too, that we've been able to create spaces where people feel more comfortable talking about their concerns, where people are seeking help more, which is what we wanted them to do for decades now. I think in addition, there has been many other stressors that we historically maybe haven't had in the same way, and that's been a new addition that maybe hasn't been a stressor before that is a stressor now. The on-demand access to things, including media, social media, what role that has played in not just our college students but in people in general, and over the decades that has had a huge impact, technology and the changes there, and financial security not being what it used to be with job security. And so I think there's so many things I could say about that, but there are many, to answer that part of your question, there are many, I think, additional stressors that we didn't have as stressors. Not to say they've never existed, but maybe they've become a little more prevalent, and access to media has certainly been a game changer for a lot of people as well.
Susan Lewis, let's talk about social media for a moment and how that's a stressor, because, you know,
ideally, social media brings people together, people who right. are, you know, many miles apart, helps friendships stay on mm-hmm. track. You can keep up with folks that you might not otherwise be able to keep up with. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily working that way.
Right. You know, for some people, it does work. It's a nice little escape sometimes from the stressors of life. And it can help you feel a little more connected to see that happy picture of the baby of your friend that you haven't seen in a while. But, you know, everything, even wonderful little escapes, can be taken to an extreme sometimes. And they have the opposite effect of what they're supposed to be having on your life. I think a lot of times we are feeling really disconnected these days. We're kind of missing some of those communal connections that maybe people did have in years past and decades past.
Social media is not substituting for
right,
that.
Right, exactly. Exactly. I feel like we turn to that because we feel disconnected. But then, you know, you have to put your life into one witty phrase for people to give you a thumbs up. And it's not quite the same as sitting around and telling stories and laughing and really being together as a community. And then also, you know, for my clients who tend to feel, you know, if they're experiencing low self-worth or isolation or symptoms of depression anyway, and then, you know, at any time you can get on the phone, especially adolescents, but let's face it, adults, we experience this as well. If at any time you can get on your phone and see, oh, well, there's that group of people who are hanging out without me today, you know, look at them having fun. That can kind of exacerbate some of those symptoms, especially in my younger clients. So.
Do you think that mm-hmm. it also exacerbates perfectionism in people? And first, I want to talk about why we're talking about perfectionism as a mental health issue, because mm-hmm. some people would say that's a good thing to aim for. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, I've heard people say, I spent, you know, an hour looking at my friend's Instagram, or I was on Facebook, and wow, I feel like my life is a pile of crap. And I didn't feel that way before I started looking. Does that play into it?
Yeah, I would say that social comparison piece, right? We don't put real – most people do not post real stuff on social media. They're posting, this was wonderful, everything's great, empowering quote, women empowering women, you know, whatever fun right. quote for Women Crushing It Wednesday, right? Whatever fun thing they want to mm-hmm. put on there. And it can be so tough because we know our internal world, right? Mm-hmm. So we know we're struggling, or we know we've had a hard time, or today was a rough day. And then people go out there and compare that internal world to somebody's external world, yes. which we're going to lose every time, because their external world clearly is everything's magical, I'm having so much fun. And especially for some of the students I work with, they see these other students as they're doing the same thing as me, look at how much fun they're having, but I'm struggling and they're not. Mm-hmm. When in reality, you don't know anything about them and whether they're actually struggling. They probably are. All humans struggle. That's just what makes us human. But they don't maybe put that out there. Most people don't put it out there in that way to be more real. And so then that comparison piece really hurts the other person, that mm-hmm. I'm inadequate, everybody else is fine kind mm-hmm. of deal. So that connection with perfectionism, which is then I'm not enough and I'm not doing things well enough because I don't have this real perfect life of what other people portray and put out on social media. My life is hard, or I have difficulties, and so I'm just going to keep striving for that perfection, which in all reality doesn't exist for anybody out there, but that's what we put out into the world, is that it is this perfect life that I'm having and everything's wonderful.
Susan Lewis, with your adolescent clients that you counsel, what do you tell them about social media? I mean, are there tools that people can use to kind of moderate not just how often, how much time they spend there, but also how they're perceiving what mm-hmm. they're looking at?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I love what Becca was saying. One of my favorite phrases with all my clients, but again, especially my adolescent clients, is when they're struggling with low self-worth, you're comparing your insides to someone else's outsides. And that's exactly what you're talking about. And we get real connection when we, you know, connect our insides with others as well, you know, our internal worlds together. So, yes, there are ways to sort of protect that I will work on with my adolescent clients to protect themselves from those effects of social media. And a lot of times, though, it does involve the parents, right? It's, you know, what are the guidelines about phones? You know, how often are they allowed to use them, and how late at night, and when are they turning them off, and are you going to check their phone, and that kind of thing. And I do actually encourage the parents of my clients, you know, even clients who are very well behaved. I think everyone needs guidelines, especially younger people. I mean, even as adults, I think we can, you know, use social media almost as an adult pacifier sometimes, and we can use it a little too much. And so younger people, I don't think, should be expected to even, no matter how responsible they are, be expected to know how to handle that. So yes, guidelines around all of that, but then also knowing how to kind of interpret what you see and just exactly what Becca and I were talking about earlier. I think we have to be – sorry, I'll say one more thing. I think we have to be really careful, make choices about what we look at when we look at them. I think sometimes stuff is just always coming across our screens and it's affecting us in ways we don't realize.
So what's a good guideline? Like, it, now let's talk to the adults out there
okay.
who probably spend too much time on social media.
I'm guilty of that myself.
And for some, it can be an even unconscious thing. Like, you reach a stopping point in your work or you hit a mental block in your work and you pick up your phone. Mm-hmm. What would you say to a healthy adult about how to deal with that?
Well, I mean, a lot of it is being mindful throughout the day of what we're doing with our minds. And so just, you know, we automatically pick up that phone, like you said. And so just having a little more structure around the day in terms of how, when you put your phone down. Sometimes I think it's good to put that app on the back of your phone so it's a little harder to click, or even to take it off of your phone. I will tell clients who are experiencing, you know, going through a difficult time of depression or anxiety, or comparing themselves a little too much to others, why don't you just go and close that out for a while, take a break from it, a retreat.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. We're taking a look at the stigma that remains around mental health issues, how that contributes to our mental health or lack of it, with two local professionals, Susan Lewis and UNCW's Rebecca Ramp. And we want to hear from you today. Have you struggled with a mental health issue, with how to deal with it at school or at work? Has stigma affected whether you sought treatment? Tell us about it on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back, we're going to hear from Ruth from Wilmington. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and today we're exploring why more people than ever are seeking treatment and how certain mental struggles are surprisingly universal. With us today, Susan Lewis, a licensed clinical social worker practicing as a staff psychotherapist at the Community Counseling Center in Wilmington, and Becca Ramp, a clinical psychologist and the outreach coordinator for counseling services at UNCW, and they're taking your questions on this Thursday. Have you struggled with whether to seek treatment? Have you found real help from a particular method of treatment? You can tell us about it on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Ruth from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Well, hello there. And I do call often when I hear things that are going on in the community that are helping people. My background is about 25 years in critical care and also down in the front lines in the emergency rooms, and then also out in public health. So it's good to know that people are out there fighting for people that have, you know, a disease, no different than any other disease that gets treated. And that's what mental health is. It's something that needs to be treated and that people can actually live with. And it's important that people need to not stigmatize something so that people go into the shadows and feel they have to suffer.
Ruth, having worked in critical care, why do you think that stigma exists? What kind of stigma surrounds it? Can you describe it?
Well, a lot of times families don't know how to deal with it because... Well, it could be socioeconomic backgrounds, it could be their religion, it could be, you know, all many things that just history, everything, just everything that they've grown up with, and then people just hide it. Mm-hmm. They don't want to have people think that whatever their loved one is going through might be off their behavior or just
I want to get Becca Ramp to weigh in on this because you deal with a student population frequently.
Everything. People that have, can't change. You can't fix a person's lifetime of troubles in, first of all, one night when they've overdosed or whatever. But then certainly when they have to go or when they go into an area where they need to have rehabilitation, usually it's an 11-day process. But you can't fix an 11-day process or years and years of problems in 11 days, and sometimes even their insurance, if they have insurance.
Right. Okay, Ruth, we need to go to Becca. Thank you so much for your call, Ruth. I appreciate you weighing in. Becca, with the student population that you have, part of your work has to be dealing with issues from families of origin, and some of that also must be students who might be ashamed of seeking help because of what their families thought about mental health issues.
Yes, absolutely. Potentially coming from families where it wasn't okay to talk about family concerns outside of the family. It wasn't okay to talk about them inside the family either, but it wasn't okay to kind of go outside of the family and wanting to deal with that internally, or everything is just okay and wanting to make it a non-issue, right? So we do a lot of work around adverse childhood experiences, which is a huge number of the population that has at least one at 67%, as we know, and trying to bring that those concerns to light, because a lot of our students also don't realize that there are concerns that they have that can be talked about, that these are concerns that are going to have a big impact on you and your development and identity as an adult. And so wanting to really create that space that's a new space for them once they get outside of the home, if they haven't always had that space and emotional support to discuss these concerns, that we're providing that space for them to be able to discuss and realize, like, wow, this did have an impact on me, or wow, I don't want to kind of behave that way anymore. Just because it was helpful within my family system doesn't mean it's helpful for me now. So it's certainly something that we see, that stigma's a part of it, and also just that realization that this may not be something that's helpful in the long run too, that they didn't know before.
And so there are kind of two pieces of this here. One being the fact that a student or a person has to be able to get past the family of origin's thinking about seeking mental health services. And then that person has to be willing to share what might have been an adverse childhood experience, a trauma, which might also be a family secret. Susan Lewis, how do you penetrate that kind of a built-in wall?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I think that we're fortunate enough to work with the folks who were strong enough to penetrate that wall. I mean, by the time they show up or make that first phone call, I mean, they had real strength to do that. And I love to point that out in my clients and really help them kind of tap into that and grow that strength. And then as they sort of work through the healing, it is amazing how sometimes that can, not always, but sometimes that can then go alter the family of origin. Maybe there's other people in the family system who weren't speaking up because it went against the unspoken rules of the family. And it can sometimes bring healing for the family itself and not just the one client who showed up. So if that answers your question.
Yeah. Okay. And even just looking at some of these agency names that are connected to federal and state government and, these agencies that deal with this issue, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, I had to sort of step back from that for a second because it sounds so pathological instead of, I guess, more holistic and evolutionary. What about a National Alliance on Happiness? Is that ridiculous? Are we talking about entirely different issues here when we're talking about mental health versus mental illness, Becca Ramp?
I'd say that they are now they're intertwined, right? Like if you have a mental illness, that's going to impact what your mental health looks like, and it's going to impact your level of what we, focus on a lot now, which is happiness and experience of joy. And that's been a more, I think, outdated term in some ways to focus on mental illness, and that was needed historically when we needed to increase access and increase awareness that people have mental illness the same way they have physical illness. And now we do try to come from the approach of everybody has mental health. Sometimes we have symptoms of different disorders. That's natural, the same way we have different symptoms, a headache, whatever it may be, of a physical illness. And that's something that can come together with this idea of holistically taking care of ourselves, which is where happiness comes in, of what are we doing in our daily life that helps contribute to our experience of happiness and joy. You're not going to be happy all the time, but there are things that we can do to take care of our health, experiences of happiness, meditation, acts of kindness, practicing gratitude. Those are going to be things that we can really start doing that are going to increase our opportunities to experience happiness and are going to increase then our ability to take care of our health in general, and that would be physical and mental. So we certainly use the term mental health and stay away from mental illness, because it is also easy for people to say, well, I don't have an illness, and so that doesn't mean anything for me, right? And so that, speaking of that, it's not something that then makes people want to take care of their health if they're like, no, that doesn't account for me.
Susan Lewis, when you spoke with our producer, Rachel Keith, you said most of us experience worry, anxiety, low self-worth, sadness. It's normal to need an outside brain and a caring ear and figure out our truest and best selves and live from that. And I just found that whole idea so inspiring. I mean, in a way, it sounds a little bit like going to the gym for your body, where you're trying to make your body the best it can possibly be.
Right. Yes. It is odd that, you know, in the world of physical health, I mean, we know it's part of the human experience to need checkups and self-care and exercise and all these things that are wonderful. But then, maybe it is that stigma with the mental health that we think it has to be very extreme for us to go and care for that instead of getting help for the whole person all the time. It's part of the human experience to need that kind of self-care and to grow, to be growing ourselves in those ways. Yeah.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about mental health, mental illness. Why professionals want to destigmatize that conversation may also happens to be Mental Health Awareness Month. With us today, Rebecca Ramp. She's a clinical psychologist and the outreach coordinator for counseling services at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. And Susan Lewis, licensed clinical social worker and psychotherapist at Community Counseling Center in Wilmington. If you have a question or a comment, you can either call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138, or you can email us at coastline@whqr.org. Christian from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I was very glad to hear some of the comments that just happened, but earlier, a few minutes ago, religion was linked in with socioeconomic as almost a handicap. But the aspects of...
What do you mean by that? Christian, can you clarify that observation? None of us are sure what you mean.
Okay. Where I was going, I'm enjoying the conversation in the show,
right.
But we all know that we are physical beings, we're chemical, we're emotional, but we're also spiritual, and looking at the spiritual aspects of mental health. And I did want to share that I have dealt with severe anxiety at one point. It was tied to some legal and financial challenges. And I did seek medical help, and I did get medicated, and I did get past that. But I'm also a Christian, and my faith plays a huge role in how I deal with life and how I look at things. So I think one of the first things that people may assume if they're listening to the program is that they're alone. And I love to hear what was just said about kindness and acts of service. Mm-hmm. Because if we discount the fact that God exists, we think we're alone. If we look at the answers that God provides, simple verses like consider it pure joy to face when you face trials of many kinds, because your testing develops perseverance. Those things are not to be overlooked because they're facts of life.
And
also aspects
yeah,
of
go
forgiveness.
Ahead.
Mm-hmm. Simply forgiving the people who have hurt us, that's a very biblical concept as well, can help us get over all kinds of issues. So I would just love to hear the spiritual aspect included in these discussions and have it not completely overlooked, or have religion, because religion has messed up a lot of things, but true faith and the consideration of a relationship with a God who really does exist has helped many, many people
and I
get over their mental issues.
And Kristen, you're raising some really important points here, I think. I'm going to ask Susan Lewis to speak to that in just a moment because she has a unique connection to this in a few ways. But tell us what you heard that lumped religion into kind of a pathological place. Is that what you're saying? Because that's the piece I'm...
It was really quick, and often things in the media are, but I tend to have an ear for them. It was along with people not being educated or having certain biases about coming out with...
About accessing
with
mental
the
health
need for treatment.
Right.
Accessing,
okay.
Being aware. And I am very aware that many churches take a very quaint, just pray about it type of approach and don't medicate. And I am not in that camp. I want to be perfectly clear.
Okay.
To not expect life to always be happy, but understand where we can get joy, for example, through serving others. When we take the goggles off ourselves and actually invest in others, can be a great source of comfort.
Right. Kristen, thank you so much for making those points. Susan Lewis, you actually have studied the role of faith in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Right. Well, so, you know, I have a degree and my master's of divinity as well. So I've always tried to incorporate faith and spirituality into what following my clients lead and doing that. Because it can be just such a source of resilience, as the caller was saying. Even in my secular degree as a social worker, it was always almost beat into us that you have to treat the whole person, biological, psychological, social, and spiritual. And so it was never overlooked in either realm of my training as a clinician. And that is one of my favorite pieces in working with clients is, you know, the spirituality means being connected to something bigger than yourself. And I feel like that's what the caller was really talking about as well, whether that takes part of, you know, that comes from a religious community or, you know, just that sense of purpose and that sense of self-worth and holisticness and kindness and forgiveness and all those things that the caller was talking about.
And it is funny. Let's talk about the importance of a sense of purpose to mental health for mm-hmm. a moment, wherever that sense of purpose comes from. Becca Ramp, I've had guests in the studio before who are highly credentialed academics, and they're here to talk about their area of expertise. And before we go on mic, they'll say, well, yeah, of course, everybody has to have a purpose, and they'll freely talk about their spiritual, you know, their faith or, you know, what kind of spiritual element might drive them. But it's not something that they'll necessarily say on the record on the air. Is there something about this that we need to destigmatize a little bit?
I think it seems to be that comfort of just being authentic, right? And mm-hmm. if that's authentic for you, the same way that caller said that that's authentic for him, that we want to encourage that more, if that's an authentic part of your purpose, which is his was such a good example of how important it is to for Susan and I, for instance, to meet our clients where they are. That worked really well for him. It wouldn't work for some of my other clients, right? So that's something to consider too, if that's very authentic for that person. And if it's authentic for you, then you should talk about it in your purpose and when you're talking about whatever you do that contributes to your health, to your experiences of joy. And so I think that is, you know, wanting to destigmatize that. Not everybody, there's not a right or wrong when it comes to religion, spirituality. It's what really works for you and what really works for this person. They can look very different, but what really fits well for you as a person and for your experience in life and maintaining that healthy, joyful experience that we all have the goal of wanting.
Do you find that that's a necessary component of mental health? Not the spiritual part, but the idea of a sense of purpose, whether it comes from an intellectual place or, you know, something that is non-faith-based?
Yes, absolutely. That idea that you have reasons for what you're doing and you're connected to the world, you're connected to the people around you, and that, again, can look very different for everyone, but that purpose piece can be so important, because biologically, just as humans, we do need to feel like we're succeeding, we're doing things, and that could be serving others, that could be just getting, you know, our homework done, whatever, you know, that may look like for that person. But that need that we are accomplishing things, we are contributing to the world around us, and that we've known for a while that that's a biological need that we all have. So of course, that purpose is going to look very different, but that purpose may be for some of, you know, our clients or just some adults, just to get out of bed and to function in the world and to, you know, do my job that day. And then for other people, it could be to change the world and to, you know, really contribute to world peace, you know. So it just could look very different for all of us, but having some kind of sense that this is what I'm here for, this is what I'm connected with, and this is what fulfills me.
But we need that.
Yes.
Susan Lewis, something that Christian said, he mentioned forgiveness was a really important part of healing. Mm-hmm. And is there a way to talk about the idea of that in a psychotherapeutic practice that isn't necessarily based in Christianity?
Sure. I mean, I think everyone deals with that. I like to think of it a lot like grief. I mean, we talk about the stages of grief. I think they're actually stages of forgiveness as well. And even stages is kind of a misnomer, right? Because you can be in one place with grief or forgiveness, and then something happens and it gets hard again, and you feel like you're not quite there. So they're not. It's not a linear process. But yes, I mean, I feel like forgiveness is something I work with clients on a lot.
Why is that important to healing?
Well, we've been talking a lot about connection today rather than feeling disconnected. And I mean, isn't the need for forgiveness when it's not there? It is something that just is something we carry around with us, and it can lead to all kinds of disconnect with other people who are important to us.
Lack of forgiveness is a way of disconnecting from people.
Right.
Yes.
And so I guess, you know, the more positive way to say that is forgiveness helps us to be more connected to people who mean a lot to us in our lives.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a closer look at mental health, mental illness, the stigma, the hope. How do you think the community, the larger culture, views discussions around mental illness and mental health? Were you raised to pay attention to your mental health? When we come back from this break, you'll have one more segment to reach us on this Thursday with your question or comment at 910-343-1138 or at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back, we're going to hear from Catherine from Bergaw and Rosemary from Leland. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today we're talking about mental health, what it really means, and how stigma surrounding mental illness can actually impact more than just people who are seriously ill. With us to answer your questions on this Thursday, Becca Ramp. She's both a clinical psychologist and the outreach coordinator for counseling services at UNCW. Susan Lewis is a psychotherapist at Community Counseling Center in Wilmington. And they're taking your questions on this Thursday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. This is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. And just before we went to break, we were talking about forgiveness and the role of forgiveness in a mental health practice and in healing. And Becca Ramp, you wanted to add something to that.
So it's something that, to pick up where Susan left off, it's something that can be commonly misunderstood. It really should be for the person when they're ready, and the other person, let's say another person involved, they may never know, right? It's much more about forgiving that situation and letting that go because of and we know this from research, the amount of health implications that carrying that amount of anger and resentment can have on your body physically. So that slogan from Vanderkolk that your issues become your tissues, right? So it's just important to start considering what we carry with us on a regular basis. And that may never mean that we contact whoever or let other people know, but it's much more for ourselves around how we are processing and working through individually whatever difficult and challenging situation that is. So just wanted to add to that.
I like that.
We have an email from Paula. She writes, Rachel, you asked what contributes to the mental illness stigma. In your setup to Coastline, you used the word crazy. not a good choice of words. Everything matters, including language. Thank you, Paula, for pointing that out. That, I have to say, was not an unconscious choice, and maybe it was the wrong choice, but my intention behind that was, let's lighten the mood and not look at this as, oh no, we're going to drag this out of the closet sort of a thing. But Paula makes a good point. I mean, just by my casual use of that word, are we crazier than we've ever been? Is that a potentially damaging use of language, Susan Lewis?
Well, it always depends on, you know, whose mouth it's coming out of. I'm not saying that word should never be used. I actually have a lot of clients who at the end of the session will turn to me, their first session usually, will turn to me and say, oh, so I'm not crazy? No, you're not, you know? And so I do think that the way that you use that word, the way that I understood it, sure, we need to be very careful of our language and who's saying it and when and why, but sometimes it's, it is still a word that people who suffer, you know, will use, and it's nice to just kind of take the heaviness off of it.
And I can see also how someone who wonders about seeking mental health services or wonders if they have a serious mental health problem. That internal talk of, am I crazy? Mm-hmm. Am I just so messed up that people would be blown away by what they saw? I can see how the casual use of the term crazy could really foment that kind of self-doubt. So I apologize for that. Want to talk to Catherine from Bergaw. Welcome to Coastline, Catherine. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just wanted to say that mental health is close to me because I have family members that deal with it, and I also deal with anxiety myself. And for me, yoga, meditation, mindfulness, and working outside, like working in my garden, is really helpful. But I also just wanted to say that thank you guys for talking about it, because there is a stigma attached to it, and that's unfortunate because it affects so many people. But I think just starting the conversation and getting it out there is part of removing that stigma. And for example, I teach as well, and a lot of my students might say, oh, I deal with depression or I deal with anxiety. And so I think it is, you know, it's changing this new generation, especially the fact that they're able to own it and talk about it is huge. So I think we're on the brink of some change.
Thank you so much for sharing your experience, Catherine. Yoga, meditation, mindfulness, how much of that, Becca Ramp, can help with someone's mental health?
Those are all some significant skills and tools that we encourage. It's, again, finding what works for you, but we add on to that the idea of mindful self-compassion and focusing on the way we actually talk to ourselves. Mindfulness meaning you're present and you're, you know, actually just trying to do one thing at a time. So if you're on your phone, you're not watching TV and vice versa. So that even that alone can be really challenging for people. But we've known from research that yoga and a mindfulness practice, a gratitude practice, getting outside and getting some of that natural sunlight and natural outdoor experience, we've known for decades that that is so significantly important and helpful in a mood boosting way and mood management way. So that, and an exercise like she mentioned as well. So those are going to be important go-tos that we typically do talk to our clients about and assess with our clients and encourage them to start doing if they're not doing it. And we have, at the Counseling Center, we have an In Harmony program that focuses on mind-body-spirit connection and does weekly meditation and a lot of mindfulness-based stress reduction programming as well because of that, because we know how significant of a change it can make and how important it can be for people.
And you also said mindfulness self-compassion. What is self-compassion and how do you teach that?
So we use I'll just speak for myself, but we use self-compassion from Kristen Nave. So it's selfcompassion.org. And what mindful self-compassion really is the ability to be kind to yourself. If you have the ability to be kind to other people, you can be kind to yourself as well. So that actually talking to ourselves in a nice way, we're quick to berate ourselves for things that don't go right. And then something positive happens and it's a 2-second, oh, that was nice. And then you move on to the next thing. So, but, you know, something bad happens and it's with us for 2 days maybe. So it's important to start having a realistic balance. There's things that we can be compassionate and kind and encouraging to ourselves about, that we can be present in difficulties, that we can be present more in those positive experiences.
So give us an example of this self-compassion technique using a typical patient. I'm not asking for you to blow any confidences here, of course,
okay.
But just somebody comes in and says this thing happened, and you identify the fact that this patient is kicking the crap out of themselves in a way that they probably wouldn't do with their best friend. How does that conversation go, and what tool do you give this patient?
We normally start with just that you said, which is we talk about the experience and then we say, and now what would you say to a friend? And it's really mind-blowing for some of them. Well, of course, I would never say that. And not even just think about your words. Some of us internally, it's our tone, it's our nonverbals towards ourselves. Like, we have this image of ourselves that we use when we're being really critical of ourselves, that really we would never even have that nonverbal tone, any of nonverbal behavior, that tone, any of that wouldn't be present if we were trying to have that kindness and compassion towards a friend. So we really start focusing on how would you talk to a friend about that, and how can we start talking to yourself that way and bringing that voice to more awareness to that voice, and more intentionality behind that compassionate voice as well. So that's typically an easy place we start, is how would you talk to a friend? What would your nonverbals be? What would your tone be? And what language would you use? And now let's start bringing that in. And it takes a lot of time and intentionality behind that to do that. And so this isn't a one and done thing. And even we do a 4-week workshop on it called Kind Mind, and it's still not something after 4 weeks that it's like, oh, go be self-compassionate and it's easy. But it's something that you've got to start being intentional about, to practice that self-compassionate behavior towards yourself.
Why are we so mean to ourselves? And why is this a universal thing? Where does this come from? Susan Lewis, give us the answer to the universe.
I'll take a guess. I think that it is protective in nature. I mean, I think that we go ahead and criticize ourselves first because for some odd reason there's a mistaken belief that maybe we won't mess up, or maybe the world won't fall apart if we go ahead and really assume that the worst is going to happen, or assume the worst about ourselves. And so I'll actually have some of my clients almost befriend some of their self-critical thinking and just start to be mindful of that and to sort of know when it crops up, but then, you know, to kind of think of it almost like a little child. Well, thank you for trying to protect me, but I don't need for you to work so hard to be so self-critical of me today. I'll call upon you when I need you, and then do exactly what Becca was talking about, you know, use some of the other more positive thoughts instead.
Mm-hmm. Want to make sure we get to Rosemary from Leland. Welcome, Rosemary, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I was just saying that I had lost 2 children. 19 years ago, my son had died from the result of a car wreck. And I didn't seek mental health or anything after his death. I was just so shocked that one of my children died. And it was very hard for me to do, but it took a long time for me to not get over. You don't get over it. But then a year and a half ago, in January, we found one of my daughters was dead in her house, and we didn't find her until the next day. Now, a lot of my children do suffer from anxiety attacks, and especially after they lost their brother first. I had 5 children, my 4 girls and my only son. So when we found my daughter, she suffers from mental health. She had not only anxiety attacks, she also had, and she was bipolar. So, and she took drugs. So,
Rosemary, I'm so sorry for your tremendous losses.
Thank you.
Are you seeking mental? Are you seeking help now?
I had, and because it took me a while after my daughter was found, and I went through the whole rigmarole of the funeral and my family gathering around. A couple months later, I met a woman on the plane coming from New York, and she gave me the name of this man named Michael from Life Sources. And she said, I think you should go see him. But it took me, that was in February, it took me until May to finally call him because I could not control myself. I was just crying too much and trying to get through days and trying to keep my family together because, you know, try to understand my granddaughter's grief because she had two daughters and I have great-grandchildren from them. Their grief and my other daughter's grief because I'm the mother, I'm the grandmother, I'm the great-grandmother, and I thought, you know, they're suffering and I should be the one to help them. So, but I was just falling, I totally fell apart and was just begging for help. So I got the name of other people first, like psychologists.
So did you eventually get help, Rosemary? I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're running out of time.
But I did.
You did?
I did. I called that number, and he was on vacation, and he called me back. He just said, I have to answer that phone. And like the other person said, that you thought to yourself, you know, why didn't I call more? Why didn't I do that? You're angry at God. You know, why the hell did you take another kid?
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of stuff. So mental health is a big issue. And, of course, it goes along with drug addiction, too. And it's so hard for people to find long-term help.
Yes. And
there is a stigma, not only to drug addiction, but mental health in general. Oh, you suffer from depression.
Right. Rosemary, I'm going to have to cut you off here. We're running out of time. But Becca Ramp, can you sort of talk about, just in her story, we see the impact of not seeking help over the course of generations.
Yeah, so that idea that, like she said, of course, it's so painful that she wasn't in a place to seek it, and you have to, of course, you have to seek it when you're ready. So that was nice to hear her experience just of when she was ready, then she did, you know, seek out that help. But that idea that sometimes if we don't, how it can impact those around us, like she said, her children and the other people who were really looking up to her. So if they see somebody who then is willing to seek out those services, how impactful and wonderful that can be for them to see. So then I want to get that myself as well, and I want to seek out those services. And it's okay asking for help. This important person is, you know, willing to ask for help in my life as well. So that certainly can have that positive impact of people seeing you reach out and willing to talk about it the way that Rosemary was, which is absolutely, you know, thankful for her for sharing that story.
Yes, thank you so much, Rosemary. And she also talked about the fact that some of her kids deal with anxiety, and that's something we're hearing more about in younger generations. More people are reporting struggles with anxiety. Why in this generation of parents who are, you know, we do have more helicopter parents, which maybe contributes to anxiety, but parents who are saying, oh, honey, you came in 30th out of 30. That's so great because no one else could be 30th and you were it. Are we training our kids to be afraid to fail? Is that part of what's going on here? Why is there so much anxiety in this next generation? Susan Lewis.
That's another really big question. No, I think you are on to something, you know, being afraid to fail. I think we are getting worse at tolerating distress. I mean, you're on to something there with if we try to do away with all of the distress, then children aren't really learning how to tolerate it and move through it. We seem to be looking for more and more escapes, and then it just becomes less and less tolerable when we do experience it. So, and I think it manifests itself in anxiety a lot. Then that would be my quick thought on that.
So we're kind of rejecting the idea of living in failure and accepting that as not necessarily a comment on self-worth, but something that it's really okay to live with. Becca Ramp.
Yeah, that idea that you're going to get, Susan said this earlier, right? We all get anxious at times and we all have worry at times, and making that okay versus making it where if you're uncomfortable about anything, then don't do it, or we're going to take you out of that situation, and that's not okay either. We need to learn how to sit with that discomfort.
That's this edition of Coastline. Susan Lewis, Becca Ramp, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast, find it on the WHQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.